From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a single tweet. As part of its Monday Motivation series on Twitter, Chase Bank offered some financial advice to its customers. In the tweet, featuring a fictional customer and that person's bank account, the customer is asking, "Why is my balance so low?" Chase Bank accounts responds, in part, quote, "Make coffee at home. Eat the food that's already in the fridge. You don't need a cab. It's only 3 blocks away," end quote. As soon as the tweet was posted, the backlash began, with many critics slamming Chase for offering that kind of advice. They called it condescending, and they pointed out, hey, Chase Bank didn't need advice. They needed a bailout during the 2008 financial crisis. Senator Elizabeth Warren was one of those critics, saying that customers are struggling because banks get bailouts for making mistakes while regular Americans get essentially nothing. Author and Time magazine editor Anand Giridharadas wrote, quote, "This is the ideology of our age, captured in a single tweet. Systemic problems recast as individual problems. Corporate greed recast as personal failure. A bank claiming to motivate its customers by mocking them for structural economic problems the bank is complicit in causing," end quote. But then the backlash to the backlash began. Conservative writer Tom Nichols defended Chase, saying Chase was in the right when it warned customers to rein in their own spending, and people who were offended probably saw themselves in the tweet. He said, quote, "Another way to look at it is this. Chase is trying to get people not to run up big debts to Chase, but we're so primed to shoot the messenger that we reject common sense advice from a bank because we think banks caused us to buy all that junk we didn't need," end quote. Well, Chase ended up deleting the tweet and apologizing, but the controversy and debate it sparked continues. This hour, our guests weigh in on not just one tweet, but on personal responsibility, systemic economic issues, and more. Let's welcome our guests to the studio. Andrew Thomas is co-chair of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Andrew, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Happy May Day.
Also co-chair is Alfred Vitali, who is also the co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics. Welcome back, Alfred. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is John Kalia, author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul, who writes a blog at Who Will Lead, whowillead.blogspot.com. John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And George Conboy is chairman of Brighton Securities. Welcome, George. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be back, Evan.
Let's kick this around the table. And first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to read the actual full tweet from Chase, and then we'll just ask all of our guests to kind of give us their initial thoughts, and there's a lot to unpeel here. What Chase wrote was this. They wrote, "You, colon, why is my balance so low? Bank account, colon, make coffee at home. Bank account, colon, eat the food that's already in the fridge. Bank account, colon, you don't need a cab, it's only 3 blocks away. You, well, I guess we'll never know. Bank account, colon, seriously?" That's Chase. And they followed up by saying that they wanted to apologize and that their new Monday motivation was to do better with Monday motivation. But they appreciated the feedback from the Twitter world. Alfred, Chase, were they in the right to give some advice like that?
No, but it's what they've been doing forever. If this was read 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, it would seem like, oh, yeah, it's perfectly reasonable. I could see this in a magazine on a single-page ad, and people would have just said, whatever. Things are different now, though.
Why are things different?
Well, it's exposed. All of the hypocrisy and the irony is pretty clear, which is why you have the responses like Giridharadas had done on his tweet, mm-hmm. And the backlash. It's not so easy to say those things in a vacuum anymore.
Andrew, was it bad advice for millennials? You know, millennials need advice like this, right?
Well, yeah, I mean...
I know, I'm poking the bear a little there.
Well, right. I mean, I think if you take the sort of broader cultural perspective about the sorts of things that millennials are getting hit with all the time, right? Like, it seems to me like Schrodinger's economics. Banks want people to save and live within their means, but meanwhile, Business Insider keeps running list of every industry that's being killed by millennials for not spending. So, there's no getting it right. And most Americans, according to Forbes back in January, are living paycheck to paycheck, right? So 78% of us or something like that. So I think it's a pernicious myth that we can even spend within our means. So the idea of foisting individual, like people asking people to forego basic creature comforts in the face of a sort of collapsing economic system, is pretty horrific to me.
Okay. John Kalia, what do you think?
Well, I'll set aside Andrew's comment about basic needs. I'm not sure that Starbucks is a basic need. It might be in my case.
Basic creature comforts.
Basic creature comforts. Excuse me. Starbucks is a basic creature comfort. I think, first of all, if we're rating social media insults on a scale of 1 to 10, where the Simpsons parody of upstate New York probably rates a 2, this one may not register at all. It's really just meant to be, I think, jocular in some sense. And, of course, anything that's a joke these days insults somebody. I would just comment, though, in response to Elizabeth Warren's position on this, that she really doesn't have a grasp of the facts, or just because she's running for president, she doesn't think she has to say something that's smart anymore. But Chase didn't need the bailout. It was forced down their throat, as it was for the other institutions that were involved in the so-called bailout. And by the way, the bailout was a loan, which they've already paid back.
But what do you think? What do you mean when you say they didn't need the bailouts?
Well, it's fairly well documented. There's a book written by Andrew Ross Sorkin, who at the time was the business editor of the New York Times, and it was actually made into an HBO movie.
Too Big to Fail. Was the book, yeah.
Yeah. And in Too Big to Fail, there was a lot of discussion about how they would use the TARP money to stabilize the system. And they realized after it was approved that they didn't have enough money to bail out the mortgage holders, the people who were underwater in their houses, and that the only way that, and of course, if you could inject that money into the pipeline almost anywhere in order to stabilize the system. So they chose to do it with the banks. And as part of the story is that they called the banks together unceremoniously, locked them in a room, and threatened to have Sheila Bair come and, who was the head of the FDIC at the time, come and inspect their books and records with a view toward finding all sorts of things wrong that might put them in a bad light or essentially penalize them. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that just get people excited. The core message of the Chase tweet was nothing more than learn to budget, which is something we all need to learn to do in order to be adults in this world.
And one more just quick point on the banks then. Mm-hmm. Are you not concerned when banks were leveraged at 30, 35 to 1?
I was concerned.
You don't think there's a cost to that?
I do think there's a cost to that. I'm not through my commentary going to tell you that I think the banks were blameless in the financial crisis.
I was worried about Alfred's health, so I'm glad to hear you at least.
I mean, the banks acknowledged, of course, by taking that, because they had choices, and they acknowledged that it was far worse to have their garbage picked through, right, than actually just taking the bailout, which I would love that option. Pick through my garbage or give me a bailout from my six-figure student loan debt, I'd be happy. Mm-hmm. But they admit.
I promise, Alfred, we're going to get into how we view sort of 10 years later the banks and whether they have a moral position to make these comments, because I would bet everything I own that everyone here has got more to say on that. But a final point you want to make there before I turn to George there, John?
No, I think, you know, I think, again, what we're really talking about here, I think, at the core of it is it okay to overdraw your bank account? I mean, there's a cost to somebody if you overdraw your bank account. So budget wisely, learn to make trade-offs. You know, is it Starbucks versus a cup of coffee in your kitchen? Is a simple trade-off, right? The bigger trade-offs get to be, you know, are you spending so much money you can't pay your rent? You know, and if you're doing that, then you've got a problem. So, I mean, to me, that's what was implicit in the tweet. It was a very narrow, the intent of the tweet was very narrow, really,
okay.
In my view.
George Conboy.
So when I read this tweet and I look at the fact that it became a controversy, I wonder why, and it boils down to, I think, a simple case of consider the source, because this is advice you would get from your mom or your dad, and almost everyone does. Now, when you get it from your mom or your dad, you chuckle and you say, well, that's because they're old. But when you get it from your bank, maybe you don't feel like you really need it from them. I hire you, bank, to hold my money until I want it and need it. I don't hire you to tell me what to do with it. Unless I hire you to tell me what to do with it, which you can do, but most people don't. So it's decent advice. Maybe it's not decent advice from Chase.
Okay, interesting. And John, I want to just hit one more point before we really dive into the bank stuff. Because I see, again, Alfred, I'm worried about your health here listening to some of what John said. But Andrew's raising an interesting point, which is that there are these sort of cheeky but not so cheeky lists of a lot of different things. Movie theaters, avocados, all kinds of things that millennials ostensibly killed because they're not purchasing or patronizing anymore. And the idea being, wait, you have,
I made a list: chain restaurants, diamonds, the housing market, beer, paper napkins.
Okay,
we're the top of the list.
Okay,
there's like 40 more.
And so, would that actually? So Andrew's kind of framing it as, you can't say that millennials don't know how to spend their money, and that they're profligate spenders, and they're the reason that they're in financial poor positions, while also saying, boy, they don't spend on these things that society used to spend on, and they're killing these entire industries, that those things don't square, no?
I'm not sure if I get the connection, but I wouldn't subscribe. I think Andrew and I probably agree on that point. I don't subscribe to the idea that millennials are killing certain industries. I mean, you could say that Amazon is killing...
I think he thinks maybe they are, but that's because they're not spending on those things. I don't know.
I also think...
Beer?
You know,
are you serious?
I mean...
It's the type of beer that we're...
Right, seriously. No, I think... perhaps certain industries need to die, right? Like, that's fine. But I also... For me, it comes back to the blame of the individual in a particular sort of cultural context and social milieu.
Well, I'm not sure how anybody is blaming anyone here, to be honest.
It's punching down.
Yeah.
The problem isn't... So I agree, George, coming from the bank, it has that tone, but it's punching down. These kinds of things are not aimed upward. These are always at the expense of a large swath of the population. And sure, it's cheeky. I understand the humor. Mm-hmm. I'm 50. I get this. I'm old. This is humor. But this is punching down. And it's punching down at a very vulnerable segment of the population, number one. Two, the issue of Starbucks is a good example. Sure, you don't have to. But Starbucks, just like most large corporations, spends perhaps billions, if you aggregate all of them, to convince you to buy this. This is part of the problem, is the supply and demand thing is a myth. Telephones are a good example. Both of you had phones when you were young, when you were Andrew's age. Mm-hmm. That lasted 30 years. Planned obsolescence, which, by the way, is a corporate strategy, is making sure that Andrew has to spend $300 every 2 years on a phone.
I still have that 30-year phone in my basement.
Yeah.
It's unplugged and wrapped up on a shelf, and I'm much happier with the planned obsolescence of the smartphone I buy every few years because it gives me way more value than that wired-in black dial model.
How much was the wired-in black model?
Oh, cost
a one-time payment of virtually nothing.
Actually, it was not. You rented it monthly from most phone companies. Yeah. You may have my black dial phone if you'd like. I would give it to you if you want to give up your cell phone. I'll supplant it with this black dial phone.
You can't because
much
laws,
cheaper.
Because consumer economy has changed because of people who invest in companies like Amazon and
not
Apple
true.
And these things that force us
absolutely
into this.
Absolutely not true. You can still use that black dial phone.
You cannot function in any workplace, in any part of the environment here, unless you're living in a cabin somewhere without need of this, without a phone. I mean, if you want to get a job, you need to have internet access. If you want to participate in these kinds of things, Chase has electronic banking. I mean, we're stuck with this, and it's okay that we have to spend hundreds of dollars every couple of years to maintain this particular thing, not to mention the cost for access, the phone, you know, et cetera.
I'm puzzled by the idea of being stuck with access to the productivity improvements we've had over the last 30 years.
That were developed by whom? Who profits from that?
By the only people who can develop improvements in our lifestyle over that 30-year period.
They're
the only people who can do it.
The improvements were not designed for our collective benefit, though. The improvements were profiteering.
The improvements were not designed for anything other than the profit of the person who designed
it,
which provided you with medicines that save your life, much better technology.
Medicines that they're incentivized.
Safer cars that cost you a lot more, but unlike the metal dashboard cars that you will lose your teeth on when you crash— they cost more and they're way better. The only incentive that can work is an incentive that provides me a profit to build something to sell to you that you can buy voluntarily or you can ignore me and I'll go out of business, which is what's happening with your Bud Light, Andrew. You're buying craft beer, and that's good, but you're not buying Bud Light, and the Budweiser people are not happy.
Well, Anheuser-Busch has bought out most microbrews at this point anyway, so I don't actually drink beer much anymore.
What I agree with you about is there are plenty of businesses that maybe should go out of business, and the only thing that should determine if they go out of business is whether you and your cohort, well, you are the token millennial here, right?
Right.
You and your cohort are willing to spend on them. You have free will. If you don't buy their stuff, let them go out. I don't care. If you don't do business with Chase, let them go out.
Let's ask Jamie Dimon how one could afford this, as he had the recent exchange with the congresswoman about, right? He couldn't explain how to deal with the $500 shortfall for a very basic austere budget. And this is the ostensibly someone you would hope would understand enough about microeconomics to recognize a strategy for this person who wasn't real, of course, was an amalgam. But, you know, $500 shortfall is very common. And there's no way to make up for that by saving. You can be austere. You can have your own coffee. But there are lots of shortfalls. And so what is the solution? Get a credit card. Take out a loan. Banks were more than happy for many years to provide that kind of loan. George, you know this. I'm sure you didn't. But the industry did. So it's just sort of pulling people further into the hole.
Well, nobody's pulling anybody anywhere. This is a consumer choice. All of the things that you've cited are things that consumers have consistently chosen, which is why they became big businesses and big industries.
Consumers
in the first
didn't
place.
Choose. You take away the marketing industry and the advertising industry and all of the industries that are designed to change public opinion, and they're gone. If it were natural, you wouldn't spend literally dozens of billions of dollars on youth marketing alone if it were just a natural choice. People just want to spend their money on things. That's kind of a little bit of a spin.
So is it your view that the advertising industry is victimizing the populace?
They're taking advantage of it, incentivized by profit, doing what they're supposed to do, which is to make us believe that we need the things that they say we need.
No economy can exist without being incentivized by profit. No one will provide you.
They pretty much did for quite a long time.
No, never. The farmer never goes in the barn to milk the cow or collect the eggs unless he thinks he can sell them to you at a little bit more than what he produces them for. That's why the farmer goes in the barn.
Because he owes a bank.
All power to the Soviets provides for the collective farm, and millions of people starved. So the farmer
millions
still
needs... Millions of people starve in non-communist countries, too.
There's way more starvation in the collectivization of Stalinism.
Recent 14
than
or
anywhere.
17 million children living in houses below the poverty line in the United States, in the most developed nation in the world.
Yeah, it's an interesting way. If you define poverty and then travel and see how poverty is defined, our conversation would change.
Really? So you're going to qualify the fact that they're living below a poverty line and that, for instance, bread costs $3, I have $1, I can't get bread.
You're using something very subjective. What is poverty? What is poverty? That's a subjective
term.
Have
you been poor? Because poor people know what poverty is.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Everyone thinks I came with a silver spoon. It's not true. Have you been to Ethiopia?
No.
Yeah.
I can't afford to fly to Ethiopia.
I've been poor. My parents were on welfare when I was born.
I was on welfare my entire adulthood, practically. I
understand what you're talking about from that perspective. But I think what George is talking about is that in a free society, we should all have choices.
Again, free society is a subjective concept. Free to who?
We all have a freedom of making choices.
No, that's not true.
We don't have choices.
You're assuming that all choices are inherently free.
I can have a decision between starving this way or starving that way, and you can say that's a choice, but that's not a choice.
We're talking about opening a bank account versus not opening a bank account, or using a cell phone versus using a landline.
Let's let Andrew jump in here, too, because Andrew was starting to make a point there. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I kind of wanted to bring it back to the point John made earlier about, like, and George's point about considering the source, right? I think the controversy around this tweet really comes, it's a let them eat cake moment. Right, for the 21st century. Like, all it really shows to me is how out of touch Chase Bank is with the growing resentment, disdain for sort of the overarching systemic problems of our economic system. And it's by and large very benign, but I really just wanted to sort of raise that point. I don't think people need lessons in basic economics as much as they need to be paid living wages, as much as they need democratic and accountable workplaces, as much as they need social infrastructure that doesn't allow them to be driven further into poverty. I think it's kind of funny, Evan, I love that you're having this conversation on May Day. I don't know if you did that on purpose.
I didn't.
But like,
I didn't write the tweet on Monday either.
Yeah, right. It's good timing. But like, we're back to fighting the same fights that our ancestors fought during the Haymarket Uprising in 1886. Like, the gig economy, all of the things that contribute to the fact that people can't pay their bills, it's just another way to extract longer hours from workers in increasingly dangerous conditions. And I think when you have banks and financial institutions putting out sort of this sort of folksy, like, parental advice.
Warren Buffett-like.
Right. That may be well-intentioned, it comes across as particularly tone-deaf.
There is some overlap between what you're saying and what I believe as well.
That
overlap really comes down to the fact that there's kind of a patronizing attitude that comes from the corporation toward its customers. Okay, so I think that's what the controversy is about. I kind of made a joke about it at the top of the hour. I kind of see it. There's a page you can follow on Facebook, for example, called Text Stories, which is actually pretty funny stuff. And this morning, the most recent one was something about, you know, grandma is going to kill us. And turned out that the punchline was grandma was going to kill you. So somebody could take offense at that, I suppose. But really, at the core of this, what we're really talking about is that when you say that the corporate leadership at Chase is out of touch with the consumers, I agree with you. I think you're right about that. I also think that we're at a critical point in our history, I've been on record. I've written about the fact that I think the millennial generation is going to save us from ourselves in this respect, because this event, in effect, tarnishes Chase's brand among those who still think they had a positive one, and I think we're seeing that's part of an overall trend with respect to how other major corporations see their brand and their sensitivity to a populace who seems to be changing its sensibilities. And I think it's going to be more and more important as the years go on that corporations are sensitive to the needs of their consumers, and they provide community-based leadership, much in the way that if you follow it, we know in this community we have a very active chapter of conscious capitalism. So, you know, I think there is some overlap in terms of what you're seeing and mm-hmm. what I would see as well. I just think that our prescription for the future is probably way out of line.
I think we would disagree on that. But I also I like the point that you brought up about the the brand tarnishing, right? Mm-hmm. I agree with you, but I also don't think that, for the same reasons Alfred sort of was citing earlier, that actually is going to change the dynamics of power or how people actually engage with the marketplace, right? Like, you can have, we had a horrific BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. and I was just reading about how now BP and other energy companies are sponsoring like concerts and festivals focused on recycling. Huh. In the Gulf states, right? So the idea there is that they're, again, shifting the responsibility for systemic problems, in this case, climate and energy and recycling, all this, back to individuals, and then revamping their public image. So there's that. Second point I wanted to make, I think, John, you said about the Simpsons cartoon that came out. Mm-hmm. This we were having a good laugh about this with the DSA chapter.
I hope we can laugh about that.
But I think it's important to laugh about it because it's there to provide satire, right? But I think where the Simpsons are funny and Chase is not is in the fact that the Simpsons touched on something really, really potent about the failures of capitalism in upstate New York. And it's something that it really resonates with a lot of people in working class and poor communities in this area, right? It's sort of like a laughing at our happy collective misery. And I think that's what good satire does.
Well, it does do that. But once again, I would disagree with your perspective. It's really not capitalism that's failed us. It's government that's failed us.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to at least... Because this is great for me. I'm talking the least I've had to talk on a program in a long time, which is awesome. I love that.
Half hour in and you can't get a word.
That's fine. It's great. And our phone lines are filled up, and I haven't even mentioned the phone number for the program. So let me do this. I think the way I see the division in this debate, I'm going to try to put my student hat on and try to crystallize this. And not just to bifurcate this cleanly as, you know, John and George and Alfred and Andrew, but... What mostly I'm hearing from John and George is that we do have choices, and that the bank's advice might have been patronizing, might have been not the best source of the advice, but the advice wasn't necessarily bad advice, and that sometimes, especially if you're 25 years old and you're trying to make a rent payment or save for the future, those little decisions matter, and that this is not bad advice, and that we need to sort of not be so sensitive to receiving it. What I hear on the other side of the table is that this kind of, to Alfred's point, this feels like we're back in the 90s when the dynamics have greatly shifted in 25 years, which is that the wage gap is much bigger, and that you've got the people who've perpetuated, who've concentrated the power and the economic authority, trying to distract the people at the bottom by saying, oh, no, no, it's your fault that you're not getting ahead. You know, keep looking at yourself. You bought a coffee this week. You should feel bad about yourself. Meanwhile, they're collecting bailouts, and they don't really feel any pressure, and they can continue to hold power, and the wage gap grows. And that that dynamic is sort of untenable. That's the difference as I see it, as in terms of how the sides are kind of presenting the argument. And the question is, what's the more realistic picture of where we are, or is it some sort of a blend there?
I think it depends on who you ask.
Well, I think that's what we're talking about here. So, listeners, if your head's spinning here at this conversation, Chase Banks' tweet on Monday Motivation started this. You won't find it. They've deleted it and apologized. But many people say they shouldn't, and Chase says they agree they should have deleted that tweet. Let's get your feedback. We've got a lot of your feedback, and we'll do that on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with graduates from the Pittsford Central School District, people of color who attended the school district and have a lot to say about their own experiences and also how they perceive some of the events, some of the issues and controversies regarding race that have surfaced in the district in the past week or so. WXXI News, among others, have reported on those incidents. We sit down with the panel to discuss it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew Thomas is co-chair of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Alfred Vitale, co-chair and co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics. John Kalia, author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul, who writes a blog at whowilllead.blogspot.com. George Conboy is the chairman of Brighton Securities. And now, some of your feedback. Let's go ahead and move through what our guests have to say. And Robert in Fairport is first. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think that the tweet was kind of ham-handed, and they probably shouldn't have taken that approach in the first place. But there really is a lack of financial literacy out there, and it starts partly in school. I don't think parents it starts at home. I don't think parents are teaching their kids basic issues in financial literacy. According to a New York Times article from the 26th of April, just 17 states require high school students to complete a course in personal finance, and that's unchanged from 2 years ago. There's basic concepts that a lot of high school graduates should know. College students should know the rule of 72, compounding money, mortgage amortization, the time value of money, the difference between stocks and bonds, and so on. And all these things could help people make better decisions so they don't bounce checks.
Robert, thank you. Andrew, Alfred, do you disagree with that?
I don't know. I mean, you get a $25 charge from Chase for bouncing a check. If you bounce the $40 check, let's say, I mean, you just cycle into something silly with this. And the amount of money that's made in 2016, I think there was something like $615 million earned just from bounce checks in that 1 year alone. I think it was $615 million.
I think Robert is saying to educate people on that so they avoid that.
But that doesn't, if you don't have it, you don't have it.
How much is the charge to bounce a check at your credit union?
I don't think there's no charge.
So the point is, if people don't want that bounce charge check charge, open the account at the credit union.
I think Chase is actually helping that with that kind of tweet.
That's the beauty of a free market. If they're doing a bad job or they're treating you poorly as a customer, go where you're treated better.
I don't disagree with that point. I would say, though, that depending on where you live and what sort of financial institutions you actually have legitimate access to, places like locally the Genesee Co-op Federal Credit Union, like there aren't places like that do that. And most of the folks who we're talking about who are living paycheck to paycheck, a lot of people are making their deposits at cash checking places that are also hitting them with massive fees. Again, I don't disagree with the point that the caller made that financial literacy is deeply lacking in our culture and in our schools, but it doesn't change the sort of systemic problem that I think
economic literacy is also lacking. Economic history literacy is also lacking.
Well, and so let me just ask John, because you know John's kind of going back and forth with Andrew and Alfred on a couple of points here. Do you think social mobility, are you comfortable with the capacity for social mobility in this country right now?
Well, I don't think it's what it, I've seen several studies on this, and they contradict one another. So I've seen, I've seen the trend lines on the Gini coefficient that would suggest that social mobility is not what it once was, and that there is certainly a growing divide between the haves and the have-nots. But I've also seen, it depends on where you're, you know, sometimes when you're making a statistical analysis, the timeline matters. Where you pick your points of comparison matters. I think there's a larger issue, and that is that we talk about the 1% a lot. There's a hedge fund manager named Ray Dalio who has done a lot of economic research. And in his latest publication, he talked about how the divide is not really between the 1% and the rest of us, it's between the 40% and the 60%. And if you look at the average income of the 40%, the top 40%, it's roughly four times what it is in the lower 60%. And if you look at the average wealth, it's roughly a ratio of 10 to 1. Sooner or later, something's got to give. I've written extensively about corporate leadership and the need for corporate leaders to take a role in the community. I wrote a book about it. I'm not sure, even if everybody accepted my philosophy, if that would solve the problem overnight. It probably wouldn't. We've had some discussions on this show, actually, about redistribution of wealth and so on and so forth. I'm not sure that that solves the problem either. I think there's incredible dysfunction in Washington, which means that anybody who comes up with a reasonable solution or even a reasonable first step has it undermined by one side or the other. So we're really in a tough spot. I would guess in the next decade, and I have a reason for guessing this, but I have a sense that you want to get in here. But
well, no, I don't know what's going to happen in the next decade. Do you think things are going to simmer over?
There's a guy named George Friedman who founded the geopolitical consulting firm called Stratfor, who wrote a book called The Next 100 Years about 15 years ago. And one of the historical points he made is that every 50 years in this country, there is some sort of a schism that results in a dramatic change in how we're governed.
And we're due, you're thinking?
10 years.
Okay. But to the point on social mobility, what I often hear from DSA is a lot of this is just about wages. People aren't all that mobile because wages are pretty fixed in terms of different social classes in this country, and that capitalism hasn't addressed that. Does it need to?
Well, capitalism has addressed it. We also heard yesterday that there are more people moving from New York to Florida than from any other state. And it's not just Florida. They're not going there to be on vacation. It's Florida. It's throughout the Sun Belt where taxes are low. Business regulation allows
no
businesses
state income
to thrive.
Tax. Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at that, what you see is people making a choice to move someplace where their economic prospects are better.
Okay.
I would argue short-term, potentially, economic prospects are better. But anecdotally, you know, with the folks that I work with regularly, like there are people who come to New York State because our social safety net provides an opportunity for people to get out of poverty.
You're making his point.
Well, no,
exactly.
but I don't think. See, I think you're implying that I'm making a bad point. But my point is ultimately, if we want to help people get out of poverty, we need a social safety net. If somebody goes, runs into a problem in Florida. They get fired from a job, et cetera. They get injured on the job. Those regulations that have been cut from most of like the working environment in Florida are going to leave that person as a burden on medical care, et cetera. And I just don't see how we balance that.
If it's so bad, why are they gaining so much more population? People must be stupid, and I don't believe most people are stupid.
Who are the people that are moving there, and what are they doing when they get there? I mean, I'm asking generally.
Well, okay, so I'm familiar with Florida. I moved here from Florida. I spent 18 years
there.
Did
you come for the social safety net?
I did not.
Okay, just asking.
Just as an aside, I came here because I love this community. I lived here in the 70s. I met my wife here. We've been traveling back and forth for years. I just love this community for a lot of reasons. That's a different show, I think. But to Florida, for example, getting back to your question, Albert, the answer is that there is... they went through a serious development effort in the wake of the financial crisis to make their state attractive to businesses. So there's a huge high-tech industry that's developed in Broward County. There's a call center industry that's developed around Jacksonville. Miami has made itself the largest hub for international business in the world. And they've done that as a concerted effort. It was a partnership, in effect, between the economic development folks at the state government level and the chambers of commerce in these different municipalities to make themselves attractive. to those employers.
And how has the economy changed at all from this, besides having more people there? Are wages increasing proportionally because they now have a
surplus? Working in high tech, on average, yes. If you're working in high tech, if you're adding high tech workers, yes, your average incomes are going up. So that doesn't address your safety net issue, but that's the answer to your question.
And relatedly, like, I mean, I don't know, but anecdotally, history all over the country right now is the same. Like, when you have those types of developments in major cities, there's huge displacement with people who used to live there and could afford to live there. And as these companies come in, there's no compensation or recompense for folks who get pushed out because of gentrification.
But it's not gentrification. It's because they bought coffee at home, or they bought coffee at Starbucks, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Let's not deny gentrification.
That's a stretch. I mean, you know, the real challenge here is that people move in because of the social safety net, and people move out who have the wealth to pay the taxes for that social safety net because the taxes are so high.
But first they try to extort, you know, favors and privileges from the state government, from the local government, to threaten them. Well, they could just not continue to amass billions and just say, you know what, I'm okay with where I am right now. I'm going to stay here and not extort a community because there are geese on my lawn. I'm bringing that up again because of various things that make me feel like I don't want to have to shoulder the support of, you know. They have choices too. Jamie Dimon has a choice. He can just shut up. We don't need to hear from him anymore. He doesn't have to work anymore. None of the people we're hearing from, Dalio, Schwartzman, who's also at Blackstone, all of them, they're all saying the same thing. Inequality is bad, and it's a threat to us. And I think you'd agree that the inequality has gotten to a tipping point where it's no longer sustainable. I think we kind of all agree with that.
Right.
The problem is they're saying this now because I think they recognize that you can't really say these things and just walk around scot-free, that you are going to get it's ludicrous to have these kinds of conversations in public discourse where you talk about this exorbitant amount of wealth, where you talk about all this inequality and not see the irony in the fact that you are representing the thing that is causing the inequality. They can't
say that. I don't think we disagree about this tweet, but I have a question that we haven't addressed. Do any of us really think that Jamie Dimon, for all the legitimate critique we could level at him, I don't think any of us actually think he drafted the tweet. So of the umpteen zillion employees that Chase has, someone in social media marketing drafted this, someone who probably heard this from their parents last week, probably someone in your cohort
It could very well have been, but it sort of fits a format of sort of meme generation in social media, right?
Sure.
Like that. So they're trying to fill, like, a specific genre.
But George, certainly the Jamie Dimons of the world would agree with that tweet. That's why people are struggling.
I think most of us agree with the tweet. A lot of us don't agree with the source of the message, how the message was delivered, and so on.
I'm not sure Alfred's fully on board.
I mean, I would if we all, if we had social safety nets where it would be possible for me to make that choice without it being a hardship on top of the hardship I already have. Like, I agree. If we were playing on a level playing field, this does make sense.
I think there's a difference between those who are in a position to benefit from the social safety net and the people that are the target of this tweet. What we're talking about here likely are customers of a bank, not customers who are living in Section 8 housing or living on food stamps.
So why do we make that distinction, though? Like, morally, I mean.
Well, from a moral standpoint, I'm not sure that I'm making a distinction. I'm not sure what the moral distinction might be.
Maybe I'm not articulating my point clearly. I think what I mean is that, like, if we're talking about if this tweet was not targeted for everyone, like, it's the internet, but if it's not targeted for everyone and for talking about, like, it takes place in a social context, and this goes back to the earlier point, right? Like, it just totally ignores the level of poverty in this country.
Well, but Chase is a business.
Yeah.
And I tried to assure Alfred at the beginning that I am not the representative from Chase in this meeting. And
you've made it clear. We believe you.
I'm not here to defend them. And unlike most of my large competitors, my firm did not receive a bailout during the financial crisis. But Cadillac, for example, or Mercedes, they have advertisements and they say, why don't you come buy this fancy car? Are people who can't afford the fancy car offended? Should they be offended? Should Cadillac not be able to advertise that they have a fancy car with air conditioning when all you can afford is a bicycle? I don't know. I'm not interested in Cadillac. But
Cadillac was poking fun at you for not being able to do it and sort of, I mean, I agree with you on that. But I think Cadillac doesn't talk down to those of us who don't buy Cadillacs.
I think
Cadillacs.
There are car companies who might say, hey, dump that old ride. Dump that dusty old ride you have. Dump that ride with no air conditioning. It's a marketing.
It's true, but it's also like cars, and particularly Cadillacs, are a luxury item, right? We're just talking about people trying to save a little bit of money. Yeah. It's poking people where it hurts.
A cab is a luxury item if you can walk 3 blocks.
The moral part that I think I'm hearing from Andrew is that we should be morally concerned that there are so many people who can't even afford or don't have any money at all to put in a bank account.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that a moral problem?
Well, I would argue that the so-called social safety net is a poverty trap. You know, if you exceed the limit that makes you eligible for Section 8 housing, for example, by $1, you lose that benefit. If you look at the aggregation of non-cash benefits, if you're let's just say that you're making $20,000, $25,000 a year, you're eligible for benefits in terms of Medicaid, Section 8 housing, and food stamps that would total another $20,000. So how do you get yourself up the income ladder enough to offset that? And what motivation do you have to move up that ladder? To me, if there's something immoral about this in terms of how we treat the poor, it's that we're handing them money, but we're not giving them the opportunity to move up the economic ladder.
So I have to ask how you think money is handed to the poor. Exactly. What does it look like when you hand? Where is the poor person sitting? Are they laying in their bed eating? What is this? Because public assistance is a big bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of effort to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no, you're right, you can be cut off for a lot of things, which is a problem.
Right.
But the cutoffs are the problem.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't think the problem is that it's disincentivizing people to work.
Right, but you know, there's an awful lot of people on both sides of the political aisle who would say, let's raise the earned income tax credit and extend the on-ramp and off-ramp and eliminate some of these programs so that people have an incentive to work in order to get that credit, and they can be eased off of it as they move up the income ladder. So those are the kinds of solutions that I think deserve consideration, but we don't talk about those things. We talk about how, you know, we need a safety net for the poor. We do need a safety net for the poor. Nobody's arguing that. In fact, the term safety net was coined by Friedrich Hayek, who was a conservative economist,
yep,
in his book The Road to Serfdom, which was published in the 1940s. We all know that, right? So nobody's arguing that we shouldn't have a safety net.
Okay.
A safety net with the amount of conditions and strings attached to it, though? The safety net that is not universal and is applicable to everybody?
Name a government program that doesn't have provisions that create faults.
Bailouts. I don't know. Bailouts.
To finish my thought, name a government program that doesn't have flaws and faults in it.
They all said
bailouts.
I'm just saying, we can get into this like we did another time where, you know, the assumption that government is the only arbiter of what government does and not private corporations that it hires to perform its administrative duties to provide services and such.
So, I would never argue the opposite side of that.
All right, let me get Lyle on the phone next. Go ahead, Lyle.
Thanks for having me. So just 2 points and a question real quick. First of all, there seems to be a conflation between, you know, commodities and necessities. So while I would agree that plenty of Americans might be able to afford a cell phone, the problem is they're not able to afford housing, they're not able to afford health care, they're not able to afford child care, and they're not able to afford the kind of education that can give them the very kind of freedom and power that some of the gentlemen on this panel claim that most Americans have. And there's been data after data showing this. Now, this leads me to my second point. When it comes to answering this problem, that most people can't afford the very basic necessities that can possibly make them free, there's also reams of data showing the kinds of policies that can ensure that people have this. And this is actually not a complicated question to answer. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, came out with a major study a few years ago called Redistribution, Growth, and I forget the third part of the title, but it basically centered around questions of redistribution of growth. And they found that the most social democratic countries in Europe were the most successful at ensuring both these necessities for most of the people in their society and a certain level of steady and reliable growth. Because it turns out when people are guaranteed a certain minimum of housing, health care, and education, and child care, and overall infrastructure, so on and so forth, they now have money in their savings account in the bank to spend, to be good consumers. And that guarantees a much more healthy economy overall. And I just to add to this, I mean, the United States is seeing for the first time a decrease in the overall life expectancy of white Americans. The only other time we've seen this in the advanced world in recent decades was in Russia after the fall of after the end of the Cold War. You know, and this was not a result of big government. This wasn't a result of socialism. This was a result of the very kind of worldview and politics that some of the gentlemen on this panel are continuing to defend and continue to call for. The reason Americans aren't able to pay for housing, health care, child care, and all the basic necessities is not because they don't have enough financial literacy. It's because their government and their society refuses to allow the same policies that the most successful societies in the world ensure. That's my comment and question.
All right, Lyle, thank you. John Kalia, is it an indictment of the current system that people are dying younger in this society?
Well, I think if you peel back a layer of that onion, which we just heard that data just recently, right, you'd find that the key driver of that is the opioid crisis.
Yeah, and why are people turning to opioids?
Because what they're suffering in small communities that used to have a manufacturing base
are the same
things that people in our inner cities have been suffering from for decades.
But it's a leak. But
it's a loss of jobs.
It's a
breakdown of family.
Well-intentioned pharmaceutical companies thought this is a very helpful product. They were incentivized to push this. We're seeing this anyway. This opioid crisis, blaming an individual is part of that problem. This is a systemic thing, and it's not an accident. I worked for 5 years at GlaxoSmithKline Pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. I understand the industry a little bit, and they are incentivized to have more people use whatever it is they're peddling, whether right. it's toothpaste or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And we're the only country that allows drug companies to essentially set their own prices for what they charge. So this is an example where that capitalist incentive is actually problematic and causing a lot of effects. And I agree, the opioid crisis is a massive, statistically and otherwise, a big dent in the American life expectancy, quality of life, et cetera. But they weren't just growing these things in fields.
But I'm not entirely sure if I understand where you're coming from here, because your response to everything is as though the capitalist system is foisting this on the public.
It is. If it wasn't doing that, it wouldn't need.
That suggests that if we didn't have a capitalist system, that it would the same conditions wouldn't exist, or that the examples that Lyle has given us of countries in Europe, these problems don't exist.
Well, the countries in Europe he mentioned have. He didn't mention
Italy or Greece, who sort of live under the same paradigm. They're not thriving. So I'm not sure that the system that they use to govern and redistribute wealth is really the culprit here.
Italy and Greece both have far-right parties that have a lot of influence on mm-hmm. the popular audience, just like we have here.
Yeah.
What we're seeing there, we're going to be seeing what they're already seeing. The rise of their right is happening here, too. And those are related to the government's in power. Berlusconi is in the mold of Trump. They're the same sort of pattern. They're extremely fraudulent, apocalyptically stupid, dangerous people who had been given a lot of privilege along the way, and then they obtain power, and it stirs up a lot of crap, a lot of dangerous thinking. Right? I mean, I don't think the issue in Italy and in Greece too, with their Golden Dawn, this isn't just government failure or structural failure in that regard. It's also the government stimulating the things that cause it to have problems in the first place.
Well, I wasn't saying it was the cause. What I was saying was that the redistribution of wealth, the programs that are common in the EU, generate different conditions in different countries. So you can't
Absolutely.
Say that that's the cause of success or failure, at least not by itself.
But they still have social safety nets that we don't have. Like, I would like to see I would be okay with a mandatory or all of us workers getting 6 weeks vacation, let's say, for example, and have a universal health care. I would be okay with that. I'd like to see that implemented, and let's see how horrible our conditions become.
How do you define all of us workers? I'm interested in some of your nomenclature.
Anybody who is working is going to get 6 weeks vacation, including the barista.
Sure. Do I get that? Because I want to get that six weeks vacation. Right?
Yeah, but would you take the 6 weeks vacation?
Well, if you're giving it to me free, I want to know if there's free. No, I'm getting off track. Sorry.
Down to our last minute here. I think really at the core of this is a question of whether there is agreement or a divide on this question of whether, you know, Robert in Fairport calls and says, we need financial literacy. People are graduating. They're making mistakes. Chase is trying to help people, even if it's clumsy. Lyle calls and says, that's a great distraction. It's baloney that most people actually have that much mobility because of the system. That's really the interesting thing is that's what, you know, MJ just wrote in and says, this is all about a tweet. Boy, you're really, yeah, but this is actually not about a tweet. This is about a debate about systems. That's what the presidential campaign's going to be about. On the left, on the in the Democratic primaries, Joe Biden is running because he's basically telling Democrats, as Matt Lewis said in the Daily Beast, I'm not Trump and I'm good enough. Whereas a lot of other Democrats are saying, that ain't good enough anymore. And it's a fascinating moment on the political left, such that it is, and nationally. And I think this tweet captures some of where that debate is. And I want to thank our guests for allowing me to take most of the hour off. So, George Convoy, chairman of Brighton Securities.
Thank you, Evan. I'll say one thing. If you don't teach your kids when they're small about financial literacy, all the courses in the world won't help them very much.
Start young. Okay. John Kalia, author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. And he writes a blog at whowillead.blogspot.com. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here.
Our thanks to Andrew Thomas, co-chair of the Rochester chapter of DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. Thanks, Evan. And our thanks to Alfred Vitale, not only with DSA, but co-founder of the Association of Working Class Academics. Thank you, Alfred.
Thanks, Evan.
Short break. More connections coming up.